Welcome to Psych Talk. I am your host, Jessica Lee, a licensed clinical psychologist. It is my mission to motivate, inspire, and educate you on everything psychology, mental health, and self-growth. Although topics discussed on this podcast are similar to therapy, Psych Talk is not a replacement for therapy and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Whether you are a mental health professional or student in the social science field, are interested in psychology and mindset shifts, or are just interested in gaining skills and knowledge to grow into the best version of yourself, this podcast is for you. My hope is to provide you with knowledge and skills that you can implement in your daily life that add up to make a big impact. Let's dive into today's episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to Psych Talk, and thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. I have done a number of episodes about eating disorders on this podcast so far, and disordered eating as well, both with guests and solo. However, today I wanted to talk about one specific eating disorder that I don't think I've actually covered on the podcast, which is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, also known as ARFID. So ARFID is an eating disorder diagnosis that was added to the DSM-5 in 2013. So it's only been around officially for the past 10 years at the time of this recording, and is lesser known than other eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa or bulimia. ARFID is also an eating disorder that I was not really familiar with until the past few years, really since the beginning of the pandemic, but is one that I see relatively frequently in the hospital. Often these individuals that come in with ARFID have a past medical history specifically related to pain disorders or GI disorders, are neurodivergent, such as having autism or ADHD, or the kids that were labeled as quote-unquote picky eaters as children. So ARFID is not exclusive to these individuals that I just described. It is just what I have observed. ARFID is also something I've been asked a lot about on social media to make content about, and I have made some social media content, but I also wanted to make a podcast episode on it so I could go into more detail than I can on social media posts. So first, I'm going to talk about what ARFID is. So I'm going to start by going through the DSM-5 TR criteria for ARFID, because we are actually on the text revised version of the DSM-5, which came out last year in 2022. So the first criteria, criterion A, states an eating or feeding disturbance. For example, apparent lack of interest in eating food, avoidance based on the sensory characteristics of food, concern about aversive consequences of eating, associated with one or more of the following: significant weight loss or failure to achieve expected weight gain or faltering growth in children, significant nutritional deficiency, dependence on enteral feeding or oral nutritional supplements, or marked interference with psychosocial functioning. Criterion B states that the disturbance is not better explained by lack of available food or by an associated culturally sanctioned practice. Criterion C states the eating disturbance does not occur exclusively during the course of anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa, and there is no evidence of a disturbance in a way in which one's body weight or shape is experienced. Criterion D, the eating disturbance is not attributable to a concurrent medical condition or not better explained by another mental health disorder. When the eating disturbance occurs in the context of another condition or disorder, the severity of the eating disturbance exceeds that routinely associated with the condition or disorder and warrants additional clinical attention. Then the DSM has a specify if the disorder is in remission, which means after full criteria of avoidant restrictive food intake disorder were previously met, the criteria have not been met for a sustained period of time. There's not a definition of sustained period of time. So I really want to highlight a few things in this diagnostic criteria. First, the disturbance is not better explained by a lack of available food or by an associated culturally sanctioned practice. Thus, if someone does not have access to food or is engaging in fasting due to religious or cultural practices, one will not meet criteria for ARFID. Second, the thing I want to highlight is there is no evidence of a disturbance in the way in which one's body weight or shape is experienced. So unlike other eating disorders such as anorexia and bulimia, ARFID lacks the body image disturbance component. Thus, the lack of interest in food or eating is not driven by a desire to change one's body shape or weight. The last thing I wanted to highlight is the eating disturbance is not attributable to a concurrent medical condition or not better explained by another mental health disorder. So like I mentioned a few minutes ago, I often see individuals in the hospital who have ARFID and a history of a medical disorder, most often pain related to GI issues. Thus, this criteria means that the eating disturbance is not due to a medical illness. For example, the eating disturbance is not due to gallstones, which are not only painful, but often cause individuals to vomit after eating. Thus, an individual with gallstones may avoid eating to avoid the pain and/or vomiting, but that is due to a medical illness. However, once the gallstones and/or gallbladder are removed and the individual heals well, if the individual continues to avoid food, that may be when we start looking at ARFID. Obviously, there are other medical conditions outside of gallstones, but that is one that comes to mind. It's interesting, at the time of this recording today, I was actually having this exact discussion with a physician I work with where he felt like a patient meets criteria for ARFID, and I was more so questioning it because I felt like there were possible underlying medical conditions we need to rule out before the diagnosis, as well as mental health components that may be playing a role. But that goes to show that you can go to two different providers and have different perspectives. I know a couple episodes ago, I covered the symptom overlap in mental health disorders and talked about how really mental health disorders are just a cluster of different symptoms. And that's why you may go to different providers and get a different diagnosis. And that was just a real-time example that we had this week, and we could both see things from each other's perspectives and why each other thought that, and we could both make a case for it. But that's something I think about a lot when working with these individuals, is that if there is something that we haven't ruled out, especially a medical condition, I want to rule that out first before giving an eating disorder diagnosis. So next, I just want to share some additional information about ARFID. So in some individuals, food avoidance or restriction is based in the sensory characteristics of qualities of food, such as sensitivity to appearance, color, smell, texture, temperature, or taste. We may see this in individuals with heightened sensory sensitivities or autistic individuals, for example. In other individuals, food avoidance or restriction may be due to a conditioned negative response associated with food intake following or in anticipation of an adverse experience. So examples of this would be choking, a traumatic experience often involving the gastrointestinal tract, or repeated vomiting. For other individuals, the food avoidance or restriction is simply due to a lack of interest in eating food. As with all mental health disorders, there needs to be a marked interference with psychosocial functioning, which may include things like an inability to participate in normal social activities, such as eating with others, attending school or work, or sustaining relationships as a result of the eating disturbance. Since ARFID is a relatively new diagnosis, there is very little information available on the prevalence of the disorder. However, there was a study in Australia that reported a frequency of 0.3% among individuals age 15 and older. With regard to the development and course of ARFID, food avoidance or restriction associated with insufficient intake or lack of interest in eating most commonly develops in infancy or early childhood and may persist into adulthood. Similarly, avoidance based on sensory characteristics of food tends to arise before age 10, but also may persist into adulthood. However, avoidance related to aversive consequences such as choking, vomiting, pain, etc., can arise at any age and may arise due to an aversive experience, hence why it can arise at any age, because we can have an aversive experience with food at any age. There is very little literature so far looking at long-term outcomes of ARFID, but the scant literature suggests that food avoidance or restriction based on sensory aspects is relatively stable and long-standing. But when persisting into adulthood, the avoidance restriction can be associated with relatively normal functioning. There is also currently insufficient evidence directly linking ARFID to the subsequent onset of another eating disorder, which is actually different than eating disorder literature in other eating disorders, because we do know that individuals with other eating disorders are at greater risk for their eating disorder to develop into a different type. So, for example, someone with anorexia nervosa may go on to develop binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa somewhere down the line. In infants, children, and prepubescent adolescents, ARFID may be associated with growth delay, and the resulting malnutrition negatively affects development and learning potential. In older children, adolescents, and adults, social functioning tends to be adversely affected by an ARFID diagnosis. ARFID has been observed in various populations and cultures, including the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, Japan, and China. And thus far, ARFID appears to be equally common in boys and girls. However, when ARFID is comorbid with autism, it is more prominent in males. Next, I want to talk about risk factors for ARFID. So we know anxiety disorders, autism spectrum disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and ADHD may increase risk for avoidant or restrictive feeding and eating behaviors. Environmental risk factors for ARFID include a family history of anxiety, and we also know that higher rates of feeding disturbances may occur in children who have a parent or parents with histories of eating disorders. History of gastrointestinal conditions, gastroesophageal reflux disease, vomiting, and a range of other medical problems have also been associated with feeding and eating behaviors characteristic of ARFID. The most commonly observed disorders comorbid with ARFID are anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, and neurodevelopmental disorders, specifically autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, and intellectual disability. And as I said earlier, however, when we see an individual who has ARFID but also has another mental health condition, and maybe some of the symptoms of the mental health condition could explain the symptoms of ARFID, the eating disturbance that we see to get a diagnosis of ARFID has to be above and beyond, for lack of a better term, or the disturbance exceeds that is routinely associated with the disorder. So for example, in autistic individuals, we do often see some sensory sensitivities, and the sensory sensitivities to food and lack of interest in eating would need to exceed that would be expected of an individual with autism to meet also the criteria for ARFID. So now I want to touch on treatments. So ARFID is best treated through a team approach, including a physician, dietitian, and therapist who specializes in feeding and eating disorders. Additionally, a speech-language pathologist may be part of the team if choking is a concern, to conduct a swallow study as well as a feeding evaluation. And an occupational therapist may be involved if ARFID is due to sensory sensitivities to help with desensitization. So the main goals of treatment are to maintain a healthy weight and eating patterns and increase variety of food eaten. If the ARFID is due to sensory difficulties, another goal may be to help desensitize the individual to those sensory difficulties. For those whom ARFID is related to fear of pain, fear of choking, fear of vomiting, or another adverse consequence, another goal would be to lessen the anxiety related to that adverse consequence. Physicians, if we're thinking about the team approach, may prescribe medications that help increase appetite or treat anxiety, in addition to obtaining weight and vital signs at their visits. A dietitian will help with creating meal plans, conducting nutrition education, and helping the individual and family determine the patient's specific nutritional needs. A therapist can help treat the psychological components of ARFID, including overcoming and coping with related anxiety, challenging unhelpful or irrational beliefs related to food or eating, as well as increase motivation for eating, along with anything else that may come up in sessions related to the eating disorder diagnosis. Because ARFID is so new, and the underlying cause of ARFID may vary among individuals, there is currently no evidence-based treatment suitable for all forms of the disorder. So like I just mentioned a few moments ago, you know, ideally, if you have access to a treatment team, the core would be a physician, dietitian, and therapist that specializes in feeding and eating disorders, but there may be other specialists such as speech therapy or occupational therapy that need to be involved based on that underlying cause or mechanism that is maintaining ARFID. So one intervention that therapists may use is cognitive behavioral therapy for ARFID, or CBTAR. So CBTAR is appropriate for children, adolescents, and adults ages 10 and up. It proceeds through four stages across 20 to 30 sessions, depending on the individual's weight. So for example, if they're underweight or not, and if they are underweight, its treatment may take longer, and is available in both individual and family supportive versions. So the individual version is primarily used for late adolescence and adulthood, and the family version is typically used for those 16 years and under. So the goal of CBTAR is to help patients achieve a healthy weight, resolve nutritional deficiencies, increase a variety of food to include multiple foods from each of the five basic food groups, eliminate dependence on nutritional supplements, and reduce psychosocial impairment. So there are four stages of CBTAR. So stage one is about 2 to 4 sessions. And during this stage, the therapist provides psychoeducation about ARFID and CBTAR, as well as encourages the patient to establish a pattern of regular eating and self-monitoring by relying primarily on preferred foods, but also encouraging early change by asking the patient, and this is for those who are not underweight, to begin to introduce minor variations in the presentation of preferred foods or reintroducing previously dropped foods. In contrast, the therapist encourages early change for patients who are underweight by asking them, with their family support, to increase their intake by at least 500 calories per day. So the next stage is stage two, which is about 2 sessions. And during this stage, it is the treatment planning stage. And the therapist will provide psychoeducation about nutrition deficiencies and supports the patient in selecting novel fruits, vegetables, proteins, dairies, and grains that they're going to learn more about in stage three that will support resolution of these deficiencies, encourage further weight gain, and or ameliorate psychosocial impairment. Now, stage three is the longest stage, and this can be anywhere from 14 to 22 sessions. So in this stage, the therapist selects the module or modules most appropriate for the patient's ARFID maintaining mechanisms. So this may be sensory sensitivity, fear of aversive consequences, and or lack of interest in food or eating. For patients with multiple maintaining mechanisms, so say they may have sensory sensitivity and they have a fear of choking, the therapist starts with the module addressing the primary or most impairing mechanisms. Although interventions differ based on the specific module, the common element across all modules is exposure. And then finally, the last stage, stage four, is about 2 sessions. And this is the relapse prevention stage, in which the therapist supports the patient in evaluating progress, co-creating a relapse prevention plan, and setting goals for the future. Other forms of CBT have also been used, and common elements across these interventions include regular eating, self-monitoring, food intake, exposure and response prevention, relaxation training, and behavioral experiments. Another intervention that has been studied using case reports primarily is family-based treatment, or FBT, for children and adolescents with ARFID. So such approaches are similar to FBT for anorexia nervosa in that the parents are charged with the task of feeding, but it differs from FBT for anorexia in that the parents are also asked to support their children in increasing not only dietary volume, but also dietary variety through repeated exposure to novel foods. Another case report examined the use of behavioral parent training interventions comprising of differential reinforcement, gradual exposure to novel foods, and contingency management. So, like I said a few minutes ago, we don't really have an evidence-based intervention for ARFID that covers every single underlying cause and maintaining mechanism of ARFID. The CBT-AR manual does have those different modules, and because it is a newer diagnosis, I am expecting that more research is going to come out, more effective interventions are going to come out. In the hospital where I work, we utilize occupational therapy a ton. We actually even have an outpatient program with our occupational therapy outpatient team specifically for ARFID. So I personally think occupational therapists are key into treatment, especially if there are sensory sensitivities. So with ARFID, most individuals can be treated at home, but some may need to be hospitalized due to severe weight loss and malnutrition. And honestly, this is where I first see most of my ARFID patients. I think I can think of one patient ever that I saw outpatient with ARFID that never had to go to the hospital. So it does have significant negative impacts on one's body. So in these instances where an individual does have to go to the hospital, the individual may need a feeding tube, such as a NG, so nasal gastric tube, or nutritional shakes to get the calories and vitamins they need. Like other eating disorders, there are also various levels of care. So if outpatient is not enough, but the individual does not necessarily need to be hospitalized to be medically stabilized, an individual can get intensive outpatient, so IOP, which typically is about 3 days a week, maybe for 2 to 3 hours. It really depends on the program. Partial hospitalization, which is more like a 9-to-5 day program. So you're at the hospital, but it's intensive therapy all day long. Or residential. And residential treatment is where you go to treatment somewhere. If you live in my state of South Carolina, you're going out of state because we have no residential eating disorder treatment facilities, and you live there for a period of time. It really depends. It could be 6 weeks. It could be 12 weeks, depending on what you need. As I'm saying all of this, I fully recognize any mental health treatment, but especially eating disorder treatment in the United States is an absolute privilege. Most people cannot afford to have a dietitian and a therapist who specializes in feeding and eating disorders and pay both of them out of pocket on top of seeing the physician. Some obviously therapists and dietitians do take insurance. In my experience, at least in the area I live, most therapists and dietitians that specialize in eating disorders don't take insurance. And I've said this before on other podcasts, that's not a judgment. I totally understand from a therapist perspective and from pains of working with insurance why that is the case, but that also makes treatment inaccessible. If you have state level insurance, a lot of higher levels of care aren't necessarily covered, or it's very hard to find. If you don't have insurance coverage for a higher level of care, it is outrageously expensive. So I fully recognize that treatment is a privilege. And if you do have access to treatment, if you are listening to this, you think you have ARFID, you know somebody has ARFID, your child has ARFID, I would definitely encourage you to seek treatment if accessible to you. Because even though I just was talking about how there are no evidence-based treatments that address all aspects of ARFID, I have seen a lot of success in my patients with ARFID, especially those that really are motivated to increase, have parents that are really, really supportive and are willing to also work as part of the team. And I've seen great outcomes. So speaking of parents, I did want to talk about parental support, because we do typically see ARFID in younger children and teens. Like I mentioned earlier, it can persist into adulthood, but I typically have seen ARFID in my younger adolescents, or like still elementary school age, compared to my older adolescents. Not that I haven't seen it in older adolescents too, but as ARFID is most commonly seen in children and teens, family support is vital to the child's success in overcoming their disorder. So as ARFID is linked to strong emotions and worries around food, it's important that families are supportive and encourage positive attitudes about nutrition and eating at home. So some tips include serving and eating a variety of foods at home to model the behaviors we want to see in the child. And that is so important. We don't want to make the kid feel like they're being othered or different because they're being served a different meal. We want to model good behaviors. Have regular meals and snacks. Have regular family meals if possible, because I also realize that is a very privileged statement in many ways, because not all families are able to based on schedules. It is important that if the family does have family meals, that the mood at these meals are really pleasant to avoid any unnecessary struggles at mealtime. And when I say unnecessary struggles, we know that individuals with eating disorder, regardless of type, have struggles around food. So if we are hyper-focusing already on the fact that we have to eat because eating is hard, if the mood at the dinner table is also stressful, that's just going to make the whole experience even more stressful. So this depends on family and individual. But one thing I usually ask my clients when we do prep for like family mealtimes and things like that is, you know, what do you want the conversation to be about? Most often people don't want to talk about food. And it's a very natural thing to do because we're like, oh, you know, the green bean casserole is so good. Or, you know, oh, how did you make this? Can I have the recipe? Things like that. And I think a lot of times it's also the parents' instinct to like praise their child for eating. Oh, you did such a good job. I'm so proud of you. And that works for a lot of kids. It also doesn't work for a lot of kids. So with regard to family meals, keeping the mood pleasant, asking your child, you know, what do you want us to talk about? Would you like us to praise you for trying a new food? Does that make it more awkward? Does that make you uncomfortable? And kind of gauge a sense of what would be helpful for them. Which brings me to my next point of encouraging your child to eat new foods, but not forcing them to eat. Because forcing them to eat, once again, is going to make a negative connotation with food, which they already have. Reward positive eating behavior. So even though I just said 2 moments ago that not every kid likes praise, that still holds true. But figure out what would be motivating for them. I mean, with my younger kids that I've worked with ARFID, usually things like stuffed animals, video games. And I'm not saying for like every new food, we might set goals like, you know, after you try 10 new foods, you get a certain prize. We've done screen time. I've had other kids think of extravagant things that we've had to reel back in, but whatever is rewarding for your child. It's also important to find ways to manage anxiety and stress around food for the child. So that could be deep breathing before meals, yoga, meditation, music, art, dance, writing, talking with them, allowing them to talk to you, whatever works for your child to help reduce their anxiety and stress. And lastly, it's also important that the parents are able to regulate their emotions and try to avoid blaming or criticizing the child for their eating struggles, because they are not choosing this, and it can be extremely frustrating as a parent if your child is not eating the food that you are putting on their plate. So this is a shorter episode today. This is it for today's episode of Psych Talk. I hope this episode was informative and you learned something about ARFID, or maybe you learned a lot if you weren't previously familiar with this diagnosis. My hope is that as we get more research on the disorder, we learn more about evidence-based treatments, like I already said, more about outcomes, prevalence rates, and ways to help individuals that may be struggling with this. Until then, if you or someone you know is struggling with ARFID, know that help is available. I'm going to emphasize this point so many times on this podcast, not just this episode, but across the board. I know getting a therapist or dietitian is a privilege to many. So if that help is not available to you, I hope this podcast gave you some insights as to where you could start. For example, increasing exposure to and volume of food intake. I didn't really go into detail, but you can take a gradual approach. I don't want to give direct therapeutic interventions on a podcast, but you know, starting with exposing yourself to smell, textures, taking a little bite, gradually introducing new foods can be super, super helpful. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Share this episode with someone who you think may be interested in it. Like I said, I hope you learned something. ARFID is something I am still learning about because it is so new, but I see it quite frequently and it's a really interesting diagnosis. And I got a lot of requests for content about it, so why not make a podcast episode? But that's it for today, and I will see you in next week's episode. Bye. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Psych Talk. I hope you found so much value. If you loved what you heard or gained some knowledge, I would love for you to take a screenshot, put it on your Instagram stories, and tag me at Jessica Lee, PhD. Additionally, I would be honored if you leave a review and 5-star rating so I can continue to help this podcast grow. If you are not already, follow me on Instagram and join my Facebook community, Grow Through What You Go Through. Thank you for joining me today, and I cannot wait for you to join me during the next episode. Remember, you are loved, you are worthy, and you are braver than you know.